Which statement describes you? I strongly prefer white people to black people. I moderately prefer white people to black people. I slightly prefer white people to black. I want to have a job again.
I feel nervous about sections of the show in which we're going to have to talk about our own personal experience.
It's nice to have the thing that you've been experiencing your whole life actually get attention, right?
When I first heard that this is what we were tackling, I think a lot of us questioned whether we were the right storytellers for this.
Honestly, we could have totally done this show with 5 non-white hosts. I think there's a fine line between taking up space in a conversation where someone else's experience is maybe more important than mine, versus wanting to model this behavior for other white people.
Diversity of thought, it matters. Perspective matters. I wouldn't honestly watch this if it was like, we're gonna give a bunch of black people racism tests. I probably wouldn't watch that video. But when I hear like, we're gonna give all your white colleagues racism tests, I'm definitely watching that video.
Few years, more and more research has shown how racial bias impacts our world, from how teachers discipline students, to how engineers create new technologies, to how doctors diagnose patients. So this season, across 5 episodes, we're going to explore how racial injustice impacts everything from education to housing. But first, in order to understand those systems, we need to start by examining our own biases and the role that they play. So, how do you measure your own biases? How do those biases fit into racism as a whole? And most importantly, what can we do about it? I'm on my way to the Vox office to talk to the director of research for one of the most famous and controversial tests for implicit bias. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks so much for doing this. How do researchers like yourself approach measuring individual racial bias?
A lot of times, you can't simply just ask people directly, hey, how biased are you? Because most people will probably tell you, I don't think I have any bias at all. And so instead, what we have to do is we have to indirectly measure how people perform or act in different situations to capture implicit biases. And one of the most popular ways of doing so is a test known as the implicit association test.
Okay, time to take those tests. And I've asked my fellow co-hosts to take them with me. So, what we're looking at here are a bunch of different implicit association tests. And what I want you to do is just choose one that interests you.
I'm gonna try Arab Muslim IAT.
I'm gonna go with the skin tone one.
White Americans, Black Americans.
Asian American. European American IAT.
And I see some images of like this much of people's faces, basically, some black, some white.
What we do is we have people sort words and images to 2 sides of the screen as quickly or as accurately as they can. And on one side of the screen, it might be black people and bad things. And then after you do a bunch of that, we'll then flip it. So now black people are paired with good things and white people are paired with bad things. And how quickly you sort on this implicit association test tells us something about how concepts are linked together in memory.
During the IAT you just completed, your responses suggested a strong automatic preference for black people over white people.
A moderate automatic association for American with Asian American and foreign with European American.
A moderate automatic preference for Arab Muslims over other people.
Little or no automatic association between weapons and harmless objects with white Americans and black Americans.
A strong automatic preference for light skin over dark skin people.
In the United States, we live in a pretty racially segregated society, and so the life experiences of white folks and black folks are often going to be quite different.
According to data collected by the researchers behind the IAT, white Americans demonstrate higher pro-white bias, as measured by this test, than black Americans, whose results are more spread out. But
unfortunately, as a tool for learning about yourself, it's a little bit noisy. It's pretty unreliable. So just because you scored high or low on one day still could mean that you might score the different way on a different day. Its best use is for 1, research, and 2, just as a way to kind of peel back the layers and seeing what might be kind of going on. behind the scenes.
Can I curse?
Go for it.
I'm like, this is bullshit.
I just don't think a 5-minute test is gonna like tell me how racist I am.
I feel like if I were a police officer and I took this and I got this result, I'd be like, I'm not a racist cop, you know, I have zero implicit associations.
It's pretty easy to cheat once you know how it works, so. There's just no way this test measures what it's saying is measuring. I just don't buy it. I don't buy it.
What do you think is a better way to get at implicit bias?
I think probably like detailed interviews with people maybe, which I imagine we'll be doing next.
Okay, so now grab those cards and just read them off.
Can you tell me about the first conversation you remember having with your family about race?
I can't, because we did not talk about race.
We are a black family, and that's just like what you talk about at dinner.
My dad, the angle that we always had around race was, within you there's power, within you there's beauty, and don't let anyone take that away from you.
There's no specific time that I formulated a strong racial identity to this day, it's still not a very big part of who I think I am.
Is having racial preferences and dating racist? Yes.
Yeah.
I would say no to this. I think people are allowed to like who they like.
I think that's problematic.
Can you describe a time you felt embarrassed by something you did or said that seemed racist?
Just a few weeks ago, I was shopping at a vintage store in Brooklyn.
Being pulled over by the cops with a black friend in the car.
This was like an older black man, and he like ran up on the car way too quick, took me by surprise.
And he was like, oh, I don't work here, but I get that a lot. And he was black, and I was like,
I definitely told an Asian kid at lunch that, you know, their lunch from home smelled funny.
I would say it was definitely a bias. I would say it's a learned bias.
And I was not really worried about that interaction. And I think that to my friend, that must have demonstrated a lot of white privilege.
Because when you turn on TV or you play a video game or you watch a movie, the bad guys are always bald and typically always black.
So to get a little bit more context here, we're going to go talk to an expert who can help. She's in Amherst, Massachusetts. And I've also asked my co-host Fabiola to join me, because Fabiola is Vox's lead reporter on race.
The implicit attitudes we show are a reflection of what we see in our immediate environment. The people we see, the media we watch, the friends we have, the neighborhood we live in, and that is the culture that leaves a thumbprint on the mind.
So Fabiola and I collected some clips that are examples of where we feel like this cultural thumbprint came from for us.
Lisa, let me buy you a soda to make up for my ancestors.
No thanks, I'm not thirsty.
I can't help it, I feel guilty.
There are two kinds of roles in this film. There's race, and then there's class. These are the roles which the speaking character roles are mostly white.
Something just arrived from New York for ya.
It sucked you in, and it made it easy to forget that these other characters, the indigenous character, the black character,
this is a black thing,
were in these stereotypic roles, because that's not what you were paying attention to. And in some ways, I think that's what media often does. You get caught up in the storyline and your guard just dissolves. And in the meantime, you're registering all of these stereotypes, which then become iconic characters and narratives, like the romanticized Pocahontas. A slight preference or a slight bias is like a few milliseconds where you can decide if you're going to shoot someone or not. A slight preference or a slight bias affects whether you're going to call someone for a job interview or if they go into the no pile. A small preference or a bias might mean whether a doctor or a nurse spends an extra few minutes with a patient. Implicit bias doesn't mean we don't have responsibility. We have control over the media we watch, who we hang out with, where we live, who we work with. We have all kinds of choices, and those choices we make or passively don't make then affect who's in our social network. That affects implicit bias.
I've always assumed that implicit bias is just a softer way to say racism. What is your reaction to that?
I think racism is more complex. Racism is structural bias. Racism is residential segregation. Racism are policies that oftentimes intentionally try to create and then justify inequality. So implicit bias, if you built it out from the individual mind to that environment, to the institution, to the society, the end result is racism.
Answering a question like, how racist am I, is complicated, not just because of the introspection required, but also because our definition of racism continues to evolve. Take just the definitions in the Merriam-Webster dictionary. They've changed a lot over the years. The term racism wasn't actually in the dictionary as late as the 1930s. But then, on November 1st, 1938, an editor at Merriam-Webster passed this note to her colleague. It reads, racism. Has this term been entered? At the time, the word was often being used as a synonym for anti-Semitism.
Hitler made his great bid for the domination of Europe.
It says the camp was founded when the Nazi Party first came into power.
You can see by the late 1930s, the term racism was added, but it was focused on overt individual prejudice. The decades that followed showed why that definition falls short.
In 1954, the court rendered a verdict of segregation in tax-supported schools is unconstitutional.
So here in the 1960s, they're beginning to add more about structural racism and institutional forces into the definition, not just individual prejudice.
But the passage of the Civil Rights Bill does not mean that we have reached the promised land in civil rights.
And events since then demonstrate why that was needed.
All discrimination, whether it's anti-woman or anti-black, all discrimination is anti-human.
What's his name?
George Floyd!
Scream his name!
George Floyd!
Scream his name!
George Floyd!
In 2020, Kennedy Mitchum wrote to Merriam-Webster and encouraged them to better clarify the realities of systemic racism. Here she is describing the need for a new definition in a TV interview.
It should be defined as not only prejudice, but as well as systemic oppression upon a group of people. That's what it should be defined as. And I think that once that change is made, that we all can come to a better understanding and see its role in society as it is now.
What we see in this conversation about the modern definition is that it's not enough to just reckon with your own implicit bias. To answer, how racist am I, you and I have to deal with our participation in racist systems, too.
Hi, Cleo, how are you?
You wrote this book that I just finished reading, A Perilous Path. And this is a book that you wrote with Loretta Lynch, Brian Stevenson, and Sherrilyn Ifill. So the four of you together are some of the leading thinkers on the intersection between race and criminal justice in the United States right now, and you all wrote a book together.
I think people need direction in how to have these conversations. I think the hardest thing is facilitating conversations in a multiracial group and have everyone feel like they have something to contribute and that they can be vulnerable.
The reality that we are making a show about race with a multiracial team in a remote environment. And so one of the suggestions that we talked about together is to have a facilitated conversation about that inside our team. Do you have any interest in doing that process with us?
If everyone is as committed to this process as you are, I would love to do it.
My fellow co-hosts and I are headed to Newark, New Jersey, to meet with Professor Thompson. He's facilitating an honest conversation, something that you can do too with the people in your life, and helping us find a better framework for how to think about implicit bias.
Bias can be conscious or unconscious, and it has to do with how we're influenced by growing up, the conversations at the dinner table, who our friends were, what we see on television, what we read. When you connect bias to action, so
I cross the street when I see a group of young African-American men coming down the street. Or I call 911 when I see an African-American doing something that is perfectly legal, but in my orbit. That becomes racism. Talk to me about what your definition is for white privilege.
White privilege is the set of advantages that you are born into by being white. Okay. And that's not to say that every white person has the same kind of privilege, the same level of privilege, but they all have some certain amount of privilege that people of other races, in this country at least, do not have.
So for me as a black person, it's about just constantly thinking about race, thinking about how my race factors into certain things, but I think white privilege is about being able to just get by and be carefree in that sense.
This is a personal and professional conversation. So personally, you would want to see people who you had some affinity toward, mm-hmm. right? But professionally, how do you access more diverse points of view?
In a professional context, it's about who's being hired. You know, a lot of us work in an industry where you can recommend people to work with, thinking about what names am I putting forward when I need a DP to come with me on a shoot, or we have an opening at a producer role, who do I want to bring over to work with me?
I think personal choices, like a big thing for me is where you live. Like if you're choosing to live in the hottest neighborhood of whatever city, like I'm sure that neighborhood is gonna be white.
This is where the potential conflict between the personal and the structural comes in, because you have a progressive person saying, I wanna diversify my neighborhood. They move into a neighborhood that's been more mixed, and maybe they are then putting upward pressure on the rents there. And so you have to think about my role in that system as well.
You have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. If we do nothing, then we live in a society that remains segregated.
I'm a little stuck on this problem of, like, I don't wanna be identifying people and sort of making them my friends because I think they're gonna, like, teach me something through their, right? Like, that's not...
I would not like knowing if someone was befriending me for that reason.
So one approach to this is to say, I would never choose my friends by their race or ethnicity.
Why don't you think that you can give them something? I think it applies to every single kind of relationship you're in. It's like it's a two-way street. I feel like this whole argument of, like, I don't want to pinpoint people, for me, it's like a denial, because, like, the first time you saw me, you knew I was black. Like, when you saw me, you were like, Fabiola's black. And so I think it really sets us back.
That was really helpful.
It's also a question of whether Cleo personally, having a more diverse friend group and broadening her perspective, does anything to change structural inequalities or segregation in this country.
Oh, Josh, you've got to decide how you change the world. What I'm here to say is, if we're going to have this conversation, and if we're going to model this conversation, then that conversation has to happen all over the country. Everywhere. I don't want your question to be, how racist am I? I want your question to be, as I go forward after this season, what can I do affirmatively? And so I'd like to ask you three questions today as we end. First, given what you've heard and what you've done and what you've said today, what are you going to do differently? What are you going to continue doing? And what are you going to stop doing?
What is the point of the exercise, John, to look in the mirror? What is the point? Why did you say this?
The purpose of the mirror is, at the end of the day, we've done all this work, is for her to be reflecting. It's the kind of metaphor of her reflecting on all of this, right? That's, I think, the value of the shot. Otherwise, the mirror is just a, you know, it's a prop.
Oh, wow. It's so awkward to look at myself. I'm, like, losing it. I'm sorry. I'm
really not going to do too much differently. I think the work that I do, specifically the work that I've kind of fallen into, I value and I'm really excited to do it. If I was gonna say I'd do anything, it would be being more proactive about not just being Ed Bradley, but being Mike Wallace at the same time. I wanna cover everything.
I'm going to stop feeling like I'm not qualified to talk about race.
I think I've for a long time had this feeling that the best thing that I could do was to shut up and listen, but I'm more and more understanding every day that that is not enough, that we have to speak up, that we have to be ready to bring more to the table than that.
I think I'm gonna stop being so guarded with my knowledge and just be more willing to share it and put it out there, because I think it's important. I think it's important for me to share and put myself out there.
I think that what we did here today was just the beginning, so I'm going to do my best to continue doing what we started. I think that I got so caught up in concerns about my role or my place as a white woman in this conversation and whether or not I would be taking up space or unwanted that I forgot about the importance of just doing the work myself and doing the best that I can.
Thank you.
Thanks. You know, I wish that I could end this episode and say, I've learned that I have this specific bias against this group of people, and I can be more mindful of that. That might be easier. But what I've come to realize is that the privilege with which I was raised and the way that the world treats me now as a white woman impacts my behavior. Of course it does. And in ways that I might not always be aware of. And if left unchecked, that can harm other people.
As long as we live in a societal structure where we benefit from racism, we are complicit in some way. We may not want to be, but we are. Does that mean we are individually racist? Not necessarily, but are we complicit in racism? Yes.
And there are signals that I can learn to pay attention to, like when I feel defensive, and when I feel frustrated, and when there's only one type of voice in the room. These issues are really personal, and they also go way beyond that. In our next four episodes, we're going to be exploring them in housing, education, technology, and health. But just because this is bigger than any of us individually, that doesn't let us as individuals off the hook.
You can maybe try to do what our brain often does, which is to justify it away as, ah, but I have an excuse. But at least in some of those cases, you might be pushed to think, I'm not going to let myself off the hook for this.
And what not letting myself off the hook really means is that it's not enough to just say, oh, I'm sure I have implicit bias, right? You have to learn to pay attention to those signals and then actually change your behavior. I want to hold myself more accountable, and I hope that you do too.
Uh-oh. I said brass knuckles were harmless.
Just keep going.
We are not done.
Oh, we're not done. Let's
no,
do it.
No, we're not done.
More.
What do I do with my hands? I never know.
Boom!